They say 60% of U.S. farm laborers are undocumented, which is the nice way of saying illegal. If the nation secures its borders, as many hope, its farms will be left without laborers. And so we ask, who will provide labor for our farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1145th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Valparaiso who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Pleased to have you aboard. Folks, you know, the industrialization of our agriculture has taken people off the land, put them into the cities. Farms have become factories designed and built around the input of money and the machine and chemical inputs that money can buy. To make the most efficient use of that money, farms grow in size in order to capture their economies of scale. So what now feeds us are large, very large farms operated by very few farmers who spend a lot of money on production inputs. One of the most difficult inputs for farmers to buy these days is the labor who do the work machines and chemicals can't do. To date, most of that labor has come from across the border. But two things are making that labor more expensive to buy. First, the federal government is attempting to secure the nation's southern border. And second, much of U.S. agriculture has moved south of the border to take advantage of that labor. Ask a farmer what their number one problem is today, and most of them will say, finding enough labor. As the input of labor is becoming ever more difficult to buy, we just have to ask, who will provide labor for our farms? We begin our search for an answer by visiting with a farmer who actually labors on his own farm and writes about it. His name is Mike Madison. He's a farmer up there in Winters, California, and he is the author of Fruitful Labor, The Ecology, Economy, and Practice of a Family Farm. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Thank you.
You are my hero, of course. The only person in California without a cell phone. Is it true? It must be true. I can think of no other Californian I know that doesn't have one. So how do you survive without one?
I've never felt the need of it particularly. I actually enjoy a certain amount of solitude while I'm working. And cell phone, I see so many people just enslaved by their phones. It's a sorry sight. I choose not to be enslaved.
So when you walk by, you know, a bunch of kids working on their cell phones and they're sitting there not looking at each other and they're all looking at their cell phones, you can kind of smile, right?
Perhaps, yeah.
So what is the name of your farm up there in Winters?
Well, actually, you know, this is a confusing issue because we never did have a proper name, but the principal product of our farm is olive oil, and it's called Yolo Press Olive Oil.
Okay, the Yolo Press Olive Oil farm then. I was just kind of curious about that because I searched for the name of your farm and I couldn't find one. And I thought, that not only does he not have a cell phone, but he doesn't have a name for his farm. That's pretty cool. And so you have olive oil. You do other things as well, correct?
Yeah, we have a pretty diversified operation here. So I started out years ago growing cut flowers.
Uh-huh.
That was an empty niche in my local marketplace. It was a high-value crop. Had a very long season, which let me spread my labor out through the year.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had a couple of months in sort of October, November, December when I had no income and no particular work to do. And that's where olives fit in. Olives are harvested at that season. We usually start our harvest in mid-October, runs until about Christmas. And then as soon as we finish harvesting, we start pruning the olive trees. So that gives us useful occupation all through those months, and then by mid-January, the flower season is starting up again.
Something tells me you don't mind labor.
Well, that's quite true. I mean, if I won $20 million in the lottery, I wouldn't change anything. I'd keep on doing exactly what I do.
Good for you. Well, I know that you, before you were a farmer, you were engaged in the tropics. What were you doing down there?
See, I started out to be a tropical biologist. I worked in South America primarily on floristics, on the making surveys of the sort of the botany of the western Amazon, eastern slope of the Andes.
Uh-huh. One of the books I'm reading right now is Plant Hunters of the Andes by Godspeed.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites. What a fun story. So, but then again, you had some kind of epiphany someplace along the line, and that you were going to become a farmer. How did that come about?
Well, actually, you know, so when I grew up on a farm. My father was a flower grower. And when I was a kid, I worked on farms. I harvested tomatoes, and I cut apricots in the fruit drying yards, and I raked up walnuts. This was back in the 1950s when child labor was considered normal and honorable rather than criminal, which it is today. So I always had that kind of in my background. And I eventually got it to a point. I went off on a different route. I started to turn into a biologist. I did that for a number of years. I decided that once I got married and when I have a family, that having to be in South America 8 months out of the year wasn't a good fit. So I gave it up. I worked construction for a few years, and then eventually my wife and I decided to move back to my home turf here in the Sacramento Valley and start farming.
Mm-hmm, there you go. Yeah. Well, nothing like getting married and raising a family to settle one down, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, amen. Happened to me, too. And can't think of a better reason. So one of the things you said in the opening of your book stopped me dead in my tracks. All agriculture is local. What exactly do you mean by that? Because we live in an era where not only is child labor against the law, but food comes from 1,200 miles away.
Sure. Well, you know, the ultimate distribution of food is indeed global and increasingly so, but the production side of it is rooted in a particular place and with whatever the idiosyncrasies and circumstances are of that particular place. So that's what I was referring to when I said that it's local, that, you know, I have conditions here on my farm that have to do with soil and water and climate and temperature that are different from any place else, and I obviously have to adapt my practices to what my local circumstances are.
And in that regard, all agriculture is local because every place is local, and in that it has its own microclimate, as it were.
Sure.
So every place has something unique to deal with. And describe your place. What made you select that place in particular?
Well, it was a place I could afford as a start for it. So, you know, California has a large valley in the middle of it. It's about 430 miles long and 70 miles wide.
Before you go on, do you think God made California for agriculture, or is it just my imagination?
Well, it's certainly well-suited to it. It's easy to be a good farmer here.
Yeah. All laid out for us.
Yeah. So this is the valley is pretty much intensive wall-to-wall agriculture. And I have my little farm is 22 acres. It's about a third of the way down from the north end of the valley on the west side. That puts me in between Sacramento and San Francisco.
So that would make you a member of the Sacramento Valley community as opposed to the San Joaquin Valley.
Exactly, yeah. I'm north of Interstate 80, which is kind of a dividing line.
Right.
And it's absolutely flat ground. I think the slope is something like 7 inches and 1,000 feet.
Wow.
It's difficult to get water to flow down a furrow even. So flat. The upside of that is that risk of erosion is essentially zero. So, and indeed, historically, this was an area of soil deposition rather than soil erosion.
What do you mean by that? Deposition?
Well, I mean, formerly when
it gets deposited instead of eroded, right?
Yeah, so there would be floods in the wintertime, and it's kind of like the Nile Valley in Egypt. When the floods subsided, there would be an additional, couple of millimeters of soil left behind. So the topsoil on my farm is about 300 feet thick, which makes it good tree ground. It seems kind of silly to grow shallow rooted annual plants in soil that deep. So I have, I have converted the majority of my cultivated acreage into tree crops. So there's apricots, figs, citrus, persimmons, and then mostly olives.
Wow. And then you take these to the farmer's market and sell them, correct?
In a roundabout way. So basically everything is processed to become a value-added product. So almost all the fruit is made into jam. We make apricot jam, blackberry jam, fig jam, citrus marmalades.
All the good stuff that make us smile.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, Mike, but when we come back, we're going to pick up your farm and talk a little bit about, I'd like to talk about the difference between farmer and farm laborer work.
Sure.
This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Well, you know, today we're picking up the subject of labor. Who is going to grow our food, ladies and gentlemen? Right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it, roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we are right back on the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What Radio, with Mike Madison, who is a farmer and author of Fruitful Labor up there in Winters, California. A little bit of paradise, I would say. What do you think, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have a diversified farm. You've got your roots deep into that 300 feet of topsoil, and growing a lot of different kinds of tree fruit. And so it takes a lot of work to do that kind of agriculture. But there's two kinds of work. And as we address the issue of farm labor, I think it's really important to distinguish between labor and farmer's labor. There's the work of the mind and the work of the body. And so I'd like to start with, you know, the work that you do as a farmer and the work that you do as a laborer. You don't seem to mind either one of them.
No, I enjoy pretty much all the work I do on the farm, including hoeing weeds and other sort of mindless labor like that. If I had to choose my favorite farming task, it's pruning my trees.
Oh, really?
Which is an art, and it takes me, I have 1,700 olive trees, so it takes me about 8 weeks to prune those every year.
Wow. Maybe I should have you come down to help me prune mine. What's the secret?
Well, I think you have to have a concept. And, you know, in the beginning years, it was, I had to really study it and keep questioning it, and eventually it became intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
So now I can do it without particularly thinking about it, and yet I look back, I just pruned 40 trees, and I look back, and they look pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So, but initially I had to think it through. I'm trying to make an open tree. I'm trying to simplify my harvest in the coming year, where the branches are placed and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And now it's, and you say it's enjoyable. Why is it enjoyable?
I don't know how to answer that kind of question, but mm-hmm. but obviously not everybody would enjoy it.
Well, it's something that takes work,
mm-hmm.
but it also takes your concentration. So you're thinking and working at the same time. So it kind of really consumes you, does it?
Yeah, I mean it's, you know, often at the end of a day, I'll feel like, gee, the day just went by and it was very pleasant and I feel good. That's immense. Nice physical labor. It's certainly superior to sitting in an office and looking at a computer screen.
Yeah.
And Yeah, it is enjoyable.
So that's one kind of work that you do on a farm, but the other kind of work is a lot mental, too, and it probably has you sitting in front of a computer screen because you're doing all of this working and planning and scheming and dreaming, and I suspect that a computer might help in that.
Well, as you might guess from my not having a cell phone, I'm also not a big computer fan. I do have a computer, but I keep my records. I have a shoebox full of receipts so I can do my taxes at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. But most of my planning and so on is in my head and not on paper or not in the cloud.
Mm-hmm. But it is decision-making labor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I had to recognize that eventually that some of the things I grow them because I like them, even if they're not particularly profitable. I've heard other farmers say, you know, you should rank all your crops in terms of their profitability and then eliminate the bottom half. But that seems kind of strange to me because the profit is not just a question of money. It's also a question of enjoyment and fitting things into a schedule. We have a spot at our local farmer's market, which is 52 weeks a year, and sometimes I'll grow something just so I can stay present and keep my presence there, keep my spot, even if it's not an especially profitable thing to have.
What are the things that you really love to grow most?
I love all of my crops on the first day of harvest. By the time I've been doing it, you know, all day long for 5 or 6 weeks, I'm completely tired of them. So, for instance, we just finished tulip harvest. You know, the first day of tulip harvest is great. Tulips are a wonderful crop. They're easy to grow. People love them. After harvesting them basically twice a day for 35 days in a row, I say, okay, I'm done with tulips. I hope I never see one again. And then I go on to the next thing. So now we're starting peonies. The peonies are lovely. By the end of the peony season, I will have had enough.
You know, I once worked in a potato chip factory for a few days. Huh? And for the first half hour, the potato chips tasted wonderful. But after that, a different story.
Sure, sure.
So you have a method about your work, you talked about how important it is to be an observer to make your work more efficient. So I'd like to go through that a little bit as you go about your labors. First thing is you have to be careful. You have to, in your observation, you really have to tune in and watch.
Sure. So it's a situation where, you know, if you're checking your phone every few minutes or you have a musical device stuck in your ears, you're probably not going to be a good observer. And also I had this scientific training to be a naturalist, and so that definitely fits into my inclination toward, you know, studying invertebrates and plants and whatever all is going on around the place. But some things, you know, the pace of life of, say, insects can be kind of slow. And so to be a good observer, you have to be fairly patient. Just squat down there and watch things for a while to see what's going on.
And that's something that you learn to do in, you know, the headwaters of the Amazon as well as on your farm as well. So
that's right.
Pay attention there.
Yeah.
And things do move a little bit faster down there in the jungle, do they not?
They can.
Yeah, they do.
The other thing is that it's important to look at your farm at night. You know, a lot of stuff happens after dark, and the kind of farmer who goes in the house and turns on the TV at sundown and doesn't go out at night is missing a lot. So I'll often go be out at midnight with a flashlight, just walking around and seeing who's doing what.
Mm-hmm. And as a night person, do you give credence to the notion that the moon has a lot of impact on your growing plants?
I don't especially. I mean, I know there are people who plant by the phases of the moon and that kind of thing. I've never seen any solid data to support that has any particular meaning.
Okay.
Clearly, the moon is shedding a certain amount of light. Whether that light is actually affecting photosynthesis or any other kind of phytochemical reaction, I don't know.
And the other thing you suggest about you know, the method of your work is that you are an experimenter.
Sure.
Why is that significant?
Well, I mean, because we don't. This is an area in which it's very difficult to have thorough understanding. I mean, there's so many variables in agriculture, and many of them beyond our control that we're never entirely sure what's going on. You can have a good idea, but you're not going to have complete control. It's not like in, say, a manufacturing situation where you're dealing with inert materials. So, yeah, I'm always experimenting with things. Like this year, I've started using rice hulls in some of my soil mixes. Rice is a crop that's grown in this region, so it's possible to get rice hulls very inexpensively.
And they add texture?
They add texture, but there's something else going on with rice hulls. I think they're changing either the biology or the chemistry of the soil in some way, because you can take a fairly stiff kind of soil and put in a relatively small amount of rice hulls, and the texture of it changes more than you might expect from a purely mechanical perspective. I'm not sure what's going on there, but that's one of the things I'm experimenting with right now.
And an experiment like that takes some time.
Sure.
Because you have to put, first you have to think about it, then you have to do it, and then you have to observe it. And how long does it take to observe an experiment like that?
Well, I mean, in the course of a year, you know, some particular, I have both some nursery stock growing in soils I'm using, adding rice hulls to, and also some beds in the ground. And so by the end of the season, I'll have a pretty clear idea, like, what was going on with that. So, yeah, it's maybe an experiment of 6 or 8 months duration.
So you're always paying attention.
Absolutely.
And it's always much easier to pay attention when you don't have distractions plugged into your ears or hanging on your belt or something like that, right?
True.
What is going on in my world? Well, when we come back, Michael, I'd like to take you to the farm itself. And you talked about the decision-making process of planting cucumbers. And I thought that was a real excellent example of farmer thinking. So we'll pick that up when we get back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host. Today we're talking with Mike and Winters. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Make that Mike Madison in Winters. Mike, the author of Fruitful Labor, and that's the subject of our Food Chain Radio program. We're going in search of farm labor, folks. Our world is changing dramatically. For many years, we built an industrial agriculture that's really relying on the input of money. Took the farmers off the land, put them into the city, industrialized the processes of agriculture. Now the farmers, all the people who were farmers are in the city. And there are very few farmers on very large farms, but they do need inputs, and they use money to buy chemicals and machinery and labor when they can't do the labor with their machinery and chemicals. But that labor is getting very hard to come by. And so that's the question we're picking up. Who's going to do the work of our farms? And to start that conversation, we're going back to the kind of farm that used to exist and still does in places like Winters, California, at Mike Madison's farm. Is that an accurate description, Mike? Is that what you're seeing in agriculture as well?
Well, there's certainly a division between what I would call industrial agriculture and artisanal agriculture. So industrial agriculture, it's capital intensive, it's fossil fuel intensive, it's chemical intensive, it's done on a big scale, 1,000 acres plus, and it relies on extreme technologies and biological simplicity. So typically this is a monoculture in which the unspoken motto is, kill everything except the crop. That's kind of extreme industrial agriculture. And on the opposite side of that is artisanal agriculture, which is typically a small scale, labor-intensive rather than capital-intensive, embracing biological complexity rather than biological simplicity, and it producing a product that sells at a relatively high price compared to industrial agriculture, which sells at a low price. In my area, the principal row crop is processing tomatoes. The tomatoes go to the canneries, and they make tomato sauce and tomato soup and that kind of thing. The farmers who grow that crop on a big scale in a highly mechanized way, they prepare the ground, they grow the crop, they fertilize it, they irrigate it, they harvest it, they deliver it to the cannery, and at the cannery gate they're paid 3.5 cents per pound. That's the price for industrial tomatoes.
3.5 cents a pound for tomatoes.
It's shockingly low, and yet they're able to make that profitable. by doing it on a big scale and by using extreme technologies. But the small-scale artisanal farmer cannot compete with a machine. And there's no way she can do that. And so she has to find labor-intensive crops, which are going to have a high value. And so maybe she's going to grow, say, heirloom tomatoes, which are labor-intensive. They have to be staked. They have to be pruned. They have to be hand-harvested. It's a fragile crop, but it fetches a higher price. And this is a trap that the small-scale farmers like me get pushed into, because we can't compete with machines. We can't compete with industrial agriculture. So we have to find labor-intensive crops. And the labor-intensive crops are things like flowers, berries, soft fruits like apricots and peaches and plums, and maybe some specialty vegetables. But if you get into labor-intensive crops, then the only way to sort of increase your productivity or your income beyond a certain level is to hire more people to help you. And it's so difficult to hire farm labor, as you've mentioned several times. Not only is it difficult to find good people, but it's very expensive in California anyway. The minimum wage is something like $11 or $12 per hour, and then there's a bunch of overhead on top of that wage, which is workers' compensation insurance, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, and a bunch of other stuff. And so basically you cannot get somebody to help you on your farm for under around $17 or $18 an hour. And it's difficult to make that person productive enough to justify having them there.
A lot of money to raise a crop, my goodness sakes. So with respect to the labor, you know, the cost of labor, there are two kinds of labor that we kind of picked up here. This the labor of doing the chores that essentially money can't buy with equipment and chemicals. And it's a labor, for example, of pruning the olive trees, because it takes a lot of intelligence, and it takes a lot of time, and it takes somebody, you know, to be there doing that.
Sure.
But there's also the labor of the mind, and you brought up the case of something as simple as planting cucumbers, and I found that most attractive, because it reminded me of farmers of 40 centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about the kind of thinking that you have to do just to plant a row of cucumbers.
So I typically, over the winter time, some of my ground will be in overwintering crops, typically flower crops, and the rest of it will be in cover crop. So in the spring, I'll mow the cover crop and work that in, and I'll work up some beds. And one of the things I'm going to plant is cucumbers. And then these questions come to mind. Like, I'm growing an old open pollinated strain, Market Moore 76, a very good fruit. Would I be better off growing a expensive hybrid strain? Would I be better off trellising the fruit rather than letting it sprawl on the ground? If I mowed the cover crop but did not work up the soil and just planted directly into the cover crop residue, would that make sense? Would there be too many pests in the cover crop, or would actually that drying cover crop keep the fruit up off the ground and protect it from rot? And there's all these kinds of issues that come into play. And then, for example, coming back to trellising, would I have to put up, pound in T-posts and put up either nylon netting or steel netting? Steel might be superior, because maybe at the end of the season I could just roll it up and burn it to get rid of the extra vegetation that was stuck to it. Or could I grow a crop like sorghum or corn to be the trellis work and let the cucumbers climb on that? And if I did that, how would my irrigation change? And so on. So there's all these possible ways in which one might go about growing cucumbers. And again, this is opens itself up to experimentation.
So there's a tremendous amount of mental activity that you have to engage in to figure out whether and how to grow these cucumbers.
Sure.
And then there was the work itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of labor is involved in that?
Again, here's the thing. So with inexpensive seed, I can direct seed it in the ground. I use a little hand push earthway seeder with a cucumber plate on it, and that goes pretty quickly. If I'm growing more expensive cucumbers, maybe a hybrid or a Persian-type cucumber, then I'm going to start them in the greenhouse and set out transplants. So instead of taking, say, 5 minutes to plant a 200-foot bed with direct seeding, now it's going to take me 90 minutes to transplant a 200-foot bed. So there's a change, trade-off in labor depending on the cost of the seed.
And all of that, of course, requires that you consider the costs and the returns.
Exactly, sure.
And how that's going to shake out and who's going to make the money if you go one way and who's going to make the money if you go the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a tremendous amount of concentration and focus that has to be done by the farmer in this equation. And since it's pretty much new every year, isn't it?
Well, every year is different for sure. I've gotten accustomed to the idea that kind of 20% of the things I do are going to fail in any given year. If I knew in advance which ones those were, I wouldn't do them, but I never know that in advance. And so they fail in different ways. Sometimes we'll have a late frost or some weird kind of weather.
Okay, we're going to pick that up when we come back and talk a little bit about more about labor. This is the Food Chain, right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
They say we spend $25 billion a year sweating it out at the gym. Sweat contains some of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy. If you sweat these nutrients out and fail to replace them, your body will begin breaking down. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients from the foods you eat. Maybe, but if you eat foods from farmed-out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com. Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than the cost of a daily latte at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Hey, folks, got a question for you. Who is going to grow your food? Big question on the table. Farm labor is going to become very, very expensive and is getting very expensive. You can ask any farmer these days, just about anyone, what their biggest problem is. And they will say the biggest problem we're having right now is finding sufficient farm labor. Well, one of the reasons they're having trouble is that the federal government is tightening up on the border. And so it's not easy to get back and forth across the border like it used to be. We've gotten rid of our farm labor program. We have one program that a lot of people are starting to use, but it's very expensive and tough to use. Another problem is that agriculture is growing up in the south of the border. So why come all the way here when you can work back there? Maybe not make as much, but not cost as much to do it either. So farm labor is going to become increasingly more difficult to find, therefore more expensive. So the question on the table, what on earth are we going to do? Going back to Mike Madison's way of agriculture, seems to be Mike is doing most all of the labor himself. Is that true, Mike?
It is, yeah. I don't have any employees. So basically I do the farming side of the thing. My wife, Diane, does a lot of the value added. So she's you know, making fruit into jam. She's doing most of the sales.
So it's the two of you?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And doing most everything. Well, as you look around, what do you think? As you look around and see your neighbors and the problem, I guess you're not having such a big problem because you're not reliant upon that labor. But what do you see happening around you there in the Sacramento Valley?
Well, there's always increasing mechanization.
Yeah.
And that process is far from being done. I mean, now they're talking robots and drones are basically going to be playing an increasing role. But it's also it's useful to understand that farm labor is not unskilled labor.
There you go.
You know, harvesting fruit, transplanting seedlings, hoeing weeds, all these things, that is skilled labor. And a good person can do it five times as fast or eight times as fast as an unskilled person. And so finding the labor is not just a question of finding some unemployed people and sending them out to a farm. It's also a question of finding people who actually have that knack who are able to do it. There is a revival going on among young people, I'd say among college-age people, interest in farming on an artisanal scale. And that's wonderful. That's great. They tend to have they tend to be idealistic. They have good sense of embracing biological health and ecosystem health. The problem they're up against is farmland is outrageously expensive. And so, you know, I was maybe the last generation who could afford to come in without any family money, come and buy, you know, a 20-acre plot.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, farmland in my area runs $30,000 per acre up to as much as $50,000 per acre for a smaller piece. And that's absolutely prohibitive for a young farmer.
Hard to make money when the costs are so high. What about also the nature of how we're raising our children? You know, you earlier talked about how when we grow up, farm, you know, we were expected to go to work, kid, out
sure.
the door as soon as you can walk,
yeah.
Get to work. Not so much anymore. You know, children are discouraged from working both by the rules of the road, but also by parents and they'd rather have you see your kid not have to work. But something's being missed there.
You know, I think I'm very discouraged by that. I think working is an important thing for kids to do. I know when I started working when I was 7 years old, and not only did it give me some money in my pocket, gave me a little bit of independence, but it made me feel like I was a useful person, and a very important thing to do. And it's, you know, I would love to be able to hire a high school kid to work with me through the summer. Just work half days, you know, 7 till noon. And they would learn something and they would get in shape and develop some self-worth, but realistically I can't afford to do it because of the way the wage and employment laws are set up.
So you would have to pay them California's minimum wage and you just get you into all kinds of sticky wickets. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also worked that way from the youngest of age. And so I wonder, you know, how kids are to learn how to work if they're never allowed to work.
Yeah, very good point.
And perhaps there just is no answer to that. So you do not hire anybody at all?
I do not, no.
Wow. So not only do you not have a cell phone, not only does your farm not have a legal name, but you don't hire any farm workers.
I do not, no.
And you figured out how to get by in the world anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just mentioning a minute ago that farm labor is actually skilled labor, and I happen to be a really fast worker. I mean, I'm 99th percentile for speed, and not necessarily for accuracy or thoroughness, but so like harvesting olives are a hand-harvested crop, or at least they traditionally have been. There's now starting to be some mechanized harvest. But while a typical person might harvest somewhere between 500 and 800 pounds a day of olives, I usually harvest between 1,500 and 2,000 pounds. And it's just because I use a lot of oxygen and I get out there and I work hard and I stay at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely an advantage for me in being able to survive economically.
And it's probably an advantage given you by the fact that your parents encouraged you to go to work at a young age, so you knew how to work from a young age, and so work is not something that's anathema to you, but rather something that you learn how to do, but also you've learned how to enjoy it. And a big part of that enjoyment, I suspect, is the fact that you're doing something that's yours and not somebody else's.
I'm sure that's true.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Right back with Mike Madison, Fruitful Labor, and you. Stay tuned.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, what are we to do? It's going to become so expensive for agriculture to hire labor that our food is just going to become more and more and more expensive. And perhaps it should. Perhaps that food should reflect the true cost of our labor. And right now, I'm not sure it does. Mike Madison, what do you think? Does the value of industrial food reflect the true cost of that labor?
Well, it's I would say our food is radically underpriced. And what that amounts to is that the industrial food system is subsidized in a number of ways. It's subsidized because energy is underpriced, and industrial food system is essentially converting petroleum into food. That's the equation that runs it. And so there's all these hidden subsidies, like the cheap cost of petroleum itself, ruinous military adventures in oil-rich countries, air pollution, and lots of public health issues and so on that should be reflected in the cost of food and are not. I would expect the price of food to be rising as the cheapness and availability of oil diminishes.
Okay, and of course that means that those forms of agriculture that rely on money-intensive inputs like petroleum products, like energy, and like chemicals and labor, the true cost of that food is going to keep going up and up and up. Now, I suppose government can find a way of subsidizing it, but sooner or later, somebody's going to have to pay the cost. And then it would seem like farms like yours up there in Winter California will have a better opportunity to compete successfully in the world of agriculture. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that would happen is if with an increasing price and decreasing availability of fossil fuels, that definitely goes against industrial agriculture and in favor of smaller scale artisanal agriculture. And that benefit is going to be greatest in other parts of the country than California. New England, New Jersey was the traditional garden state for Manhattan. Other parts of the country where small-scale agriculture once flourished and is less productive right now are going to come back to life quite well. In California, where a lot of product goes to distant markets, an increasing cost of production, transportation is going to be rather against the development of agriculture. But it will. I believe that this would shift in favor of small labor-intensive farms and away from extreme technologies.
And the future?
Yeah, you know, I encourage the young farmers who I know to try to secure a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year lease on a good piece of land, close to their markets, excellent soils, and go ahead and pursue labor-intensive kinds of farming. I think the future for that is actually quite good.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Mike Madison, Fruitful Labor is the name of his book, The Ecology, Economy, and Practice of a Family Farm. Thank you for joining us, and I think you're right. By golly, I think there's a future because we all have to eat, and we all love to eat things that make us feel good. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Mike Madison and you. Thank you for all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.